or items of food like carrots or pumpkins, rather than zombies, vampires, or characters from slasher films. A memo from a Los Angeles school carried the following costume advisory. They should not depict gangs or horror characters or be scary. Masks are allowed only during the parade. Costumes may not demean any race, religion, nationality, handicapped condition, or gender. No fake fingernails. No weapons, even fake ones. Elsewhere in California, a mother who thought that her children might be frightened by the Halloween tombstones and monsters in a neighbor's yard called the police to report it as a hate crime. The historical increase in the valuation of children has entered its decadent phase. Now that children are safe from being smothered on the day they are born, starved in foundling homes, poisoned by wet nurses, beaten to death by fathers, cooked in pies by stepmothers, worked to death in mines and mills, felled by infectious diseases, and beaten up by bullies, experts have racked their brains for ways to eke infinitesimal increments of safety from a curve of diminishing or even reversing returns. Children are not allowed to be outside in the middle of the day, skin cancer, to play in the grass, deer ticks, to buy lemonade from a stand, bacteria on lemon peel, or to lick cake batter off spoons, salmonella from uncooked eggs. Lawyer-vetted playgrounds have had their turf padded with rubber, their slides and monkey bars lowered to waist height, and their seesaws removed altogether, so that the kid at the bottom can't jump off and watch the kid at the top come hurtling to the ground, the most fun part of playing on a seesaw. When the producers of Sesame Street issued a set of DVDs containing classic programs from the first years of the series, 1969 through 74, they included a warning on the box that the shows were not suitable for children. The programs showed kids engaging in dangerous activities like climbing on monkey bars, riding tricycles without helmets, wriggling through pipes, and accepting milk and cookies from kindly strangers. Censored altogether was Monsterpiece Theater, because at the end of each episode, the ascotted, smoking-jacketed host, Alistair Cookie, played by Cookie Monster, gobbled down his pipe, which glamorizes the use of tobacco products and depicts a choking hazard. But nothing has transformed childhood as much as the risk of kidnapping by strangers, a textbook case in the psychology of fear. Since 1979, when 6-year-old Eitan Potts disappeared on his way to a school bus stop in Lower Manhattan, kidnapped children have riveted the nation's attention, thanks to three interest groups that are dedicated to sowing panic among the nation's parents. The grief-stricken parents of murdered children understandably want something good to come out of their tragedies, and several have devoted their lives to raising awareness of child abductions. One of them, John Walsh, campaigned to have photographs of missing children featured on milk cartons and hosted a lurid television program, America's Most Wanted, which specialized in horrific kidnap murders. Politicians, police chiefs, and corporate publicists can smell a no-lose campaign from a mile away. Who could be against protecting children from perverts and have held ostentatious ceremonies to announce protective measures named after missing children? Code Adam, Amber Alerts, Megan's Law, the National Missing Children Day. The media, too, can recognize a ratings pump when they see one, and have stoked the fear with round-the-clock vigils, documentaries in constant rotation. It is every parent's nightmare, and a Law and Order spin-off dedicated to nothing but sex crimes. Childhood has never been the same. American parents will not let their children out of their sight. Children are chauffeured, chaperoned, and tethered with cell phones, which, far from reducing parents' anxiety, only sends them into a tizzy if a child doesn't answer on the first ring. Making friends in the playground has given way to mother-arranged play dates, a phrase that didn't exist before the 1980s. 40 years ago, 2/3 of children walked or biked to school. Today, 10% do. A generation ago, 70% of children played outside. Today, the rate is down to 30%. In 2008, the 9-year-old son of the journalist Lenore Skenazy begged her to let him go home by himself on the New York subway. She agreed, and he made it home without incident. When she wrote about the vignette in a New York Sun column, she found herself at the center of a media frenzy in which she was dubbed America's Worst Mom. Sample headline, Mom Lets 9-Year-Old Take Subway Home Alone. Columnist Stirs Controversy with Experiment in Childhood Independence. In response, she started a movement, Free Range Children, and proposed national Take Our Children to the Park and Leave Them There Day, intended to get children to learn to play by themselves without constant adult supervision. Skenazy is not, in fact, America's worst mom. She simply did what no politician, policeman, parent, or producer ever did. She looked up the facts. The overwhelming majority of milk carton children were not lured into vans by sex perverts, child traffickers, or ransom artists, but were teenagers who ran away from home, or children taken by a divorced parent who was embittered by an unfavorable custody ruling. The annual number of abductions by strangers has ranged from 200 to 300 in the 1990s to about 100 today, around half of whom are murdered. With 50 million children in the United States, that works out to an annual homicide rate of 1 in a million, 0.001 per 100,000, to use our usual metric. That's about a 20th of the risk of drowning and a 40th of the risk of a fatal car accident. The writer Warwick Cairns calculated that if you wanted your child to be kidnapped and held overnight by a stranger, you'd have to leave the child outside and unattended for 750,000 years. One might reply that the safety of a child is so precious that even if these precautions saved a few lives a year, they would be worth the anxiety and expense. But the reasoning is spurious. People inescapably trade off safety for other good things in life, as when they set aside money for their children's college education rather than installing a sprinkler system in their homes, or drive with their children to a vacation destination rather than letting them play video games in the safety of their bedrooms all summer. The campaign for perfect safety from abductions ignores costs like constricting childhood experience, increasing childhood obesity, instilling chronic anxiety in working women, and scaring young adults away from having children. And even if minimizing risk were the only good in life, the innumerate safety advisories would not accomplish it. Many measures, like the milk carton wanted posters, are examples of what criminologists call crime control theater. They advertise that something is being done without actually doing anything. When 30 million people change their lives to reduce a risk to 50 people, they will probably do more harm than good, because of the unforeseen consequences of their adjustments on the vastly more than 50 people who are affected by them. To take just two examples, more than twice as many children are hit by cars driven by parents taking their children to school as by any other kinds of traffic. So, when more parents drive their children to school to prevent them from getting killed by kidnappers, more children get killed. And one form of crime control theater, electronic highway signs that display the names of missing children to drivers on freeways, may cause slowdowns, distracted drivers, and the inevitable accidents. The movement over the past two centuries to increase the valuation of children's lives is one of the great moral advances in history. But the movement over the past two decades to increase the valuation to infinity can lead only to absurdities. Gay rights, the decline of gay bashing, and the decriminalization of homosexuality. It would be an exaggeration to say that the British mathematician Alan Turing explained the nature of logical and mathematical reasoning, invented the digital computer, solved the mind-body problem, and saved Western civilization, but it would not be much of an exaggeration. In a landmark 1936 paper, Turing laid out a set of simple mechanical operations that was sufficient to compute any mathematical or logical formula that was computable at all. These operations could easily be implemented in a machine, a digital computer, and a decade later, Turing designed a practicable version that served as a prototype for the computers we use today. In the interim, he worked for the British Decryption Unit during World War II and helped to crack the cipher used by the Nazis to communicate with their U-boats, which was instrumental in defeating the German naval blockade and turning around the war. When the war was over, Turing wrote a paper, still widely read today, that equated thinking with computation, thereby offering an explanation of how intelligence could be carried out by a physical system. For good measure, he then tackled one of the hardest problems in science: how the structure of an organism could emerge from a pool of chemicals during embryonic development, and proposed an ingenious solution. How did Western civilization thank one of the greatest geniuses it ever produced? In 1952, the British government arrested him, withdrew his security clearance, threatened him with prison, and chemically castrated him, driving him to suicide at the age of 42. What did Turing do to earn this stunning display of ingratitude? He had sex with a man. Homosexual acts were illegal in Britain at the time, and he was charged with gross indecency, under the same statute that in the preceding century had broken another genius, Oscar Wilde. Turing's persecution was motivated by a fear that homosexuals were vulnerable to being entrapped by Soviet agents. The fear became risible 8 years later when the British War Secretary John Profumo was forced to resign because he had had an affair with the mistress of a Soviet spy. At least since Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13, prescribed the death penalty for a man lying with mankind as he lieth with a woman, many governments have used their monopoly on violence to imprison, torture, mutilate, and kill homosexuals. A gay person who escaped government violence in the form of laws against indecency, sodomy, buggery, unnatural acts, or crimes against nature was vulnerable to violence from his fellow citizens in the form of gay bashing, homophobic violence, and anti-gay hate crimes. Homophobic violence, whether state-sponsored or grassroots, is a mysterious entity in the catalog of human violence, because there is nothing in it for the aggressor. No contested resource is at stake, and since homosexuality is a victimless crime, no peace is gained by deterring it. If anything, one might expect straight men to react to their gay fellows by thinking, "Great! More women for me!" By the same logic, lesbianism should be the most heinous crime imaginable because it takes women out of the mating pool two at a time. But homophobia has been more prominent in history than lesbophobia. While many legal systems single out male homosexuality for criminalization, no legal system singles out lesbianism, and hate crimes against gay men outnumber hate crimes against gay women by a ratio of almost 5-1. Homophobia is an evolutionary puzzle, as is homosexuality itself. It's not that there's anything mysterious about homosexual behavior. Humans are a polymorphously perverse species, and now and again seek sexual gratification from all manner of living and non-living things that don't contribute to their reproductive output. Men in all male settings, such as ships, prisons, and boarding schools, often make do with the available object that resembles a female body more closely than anything else in the vicinity. Pederasty, which offers a softer, smoother, and more docile object, has been institutionalized in a number of societies, including, famously, the elite of ancient Greece. When homosexual behavior is institutionalized, not surprisingly, there is little homophobia as we know it. Women, for their part, are less ardent but more flexible in their sexuality, and many go through phases in life when they are happily celibate, promiscuous, monogamous, or homosexual. Hence the phenomenon in American women's colleges of the LUG, lesbian until graduation. The real puzzle is homosexual orientation. Why should there be men and women who consistently prefer homosexual mating opportunities to heterosexual ones, or who avoid mating with the opposite sex altogether? At least in men, homosexual orientation appears to be inborn. Gay men generally report that their homosexual attractions began as soon as they felt sexual stirrings shortly before adolescence. and homosexuality is more concordant and identical than in fraternal twins, suggesting that their shared genes play a role. Homosexuality, by the way, is one of the few examples of a nature-nurture debate in which the politically correct position is nature. If homosexuality is innate, according to the common understanding, then people don't choose to be gay, and hence can't be criticized for their lifestyle. Nor could they convert the children in their classrooms or Boy Scout troops if they wanted to. The evolutionary mystery is how any genetic tendency to avoid heterosexual sex can remain in a population for long, since it would have consigned the person to few or no offspring. Perhaps gay genes have a compensating advantage, like enhancing fertility when they are carried by women, particularly if they are on the X chromosome, which women have in two copies. The advantage to women would need to be only a bit more than half the disadvantage to men for the gene to spread. Perhaps the putative gay genes lead to homosexuality only in certain environments, which didn't exist while our genes were selected. One ethnographic survey found that in almost 60% of pre-literate societies, homosexuality was unknown or extremely rare. Or perhaps the genes work indirectly by making a fetus susceptible to fluctuations in hormones or antibodies which affect its developing brain. Whatever the explanation, people with a homosexual orientation who grow up in a society that does not cultivate homosexual behavior may find themselves the target of a society-wide hostility. Among traditional societies that take note of homosexuality in their midst, more than twice as many disapprove of it as tolerate it. And in traditional and modern societies alike, the intolerance can erupt in violence. Bullies and toughs may see an easy mark on whom they can prove their machismo to an audience or to one another. And lawmakers may have moralistic convictions about homosexuality that they translate into commandments and statutes. These beliefs may be products of the crosswiring between disgust and morality that leads people to confuse visceral revulsion with objective sinfulness. That short circuit may convert an impulse to avoid homosexual partners into an impulse to condemn homosexuality. At least since biblical times, homophobic sentiments have been translated into laws that punish homosexuals with death or mutilation, especially in Christian and Muslim kingdoms and their former colonies. A chilling 20th century example was the targeting of homosexuals for elimination during the Holocaust. During the Enlightenment, the questioning of any moral precept that was based on visceral impulse or religious dogma led to a new look at homosexuality. Montesquieu and Voltaire argued that homosexuality should be decriminalized, though they didn't go so far as to say that it was morally acceptable. In 1785, Jeremy Bentham took the next step. Using utilitarian reasoning, which equates morality with whatever brings the greatest good to the greatest number, Bentham argued that there is nothing immoral about homosexual acts because they make no one worse off. Homosexuality was legalized in France after the Revolution and in a smattering of other countries in the ensuing decades. The movement picked up in the middle of the 20th century and blasted off in the 1970s and 1990s, as the gay rights movement was fueled by the ideal of human rights. Today, homosexuality has been legalized in almost 120 countries, though laws against it remain on the books of another 80, mostly in Africa, the Caribbean, Oceania, and the Islamic world. Worse, homosexuality is punishable by death in Mauritania, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Yemen, parts of Nigeria, parts of Somalia, and all of Iran, despite, according to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, not existing in that country. But the pressure is on. Every human rights organization considers the criminalization of homosexuality to be a human rights violation. And in 2008, in the UN General Assembly, 66 countries endorsed a declaration urging that all such laws be repealed. In a statement endorsing the declaration, Navanatham Pillai, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, wrote, "The principle of universality admits no exception. Human rights truly are the birthright of all human beings." The decriminalization of homosexuality began later in the United States. As late as 1969, homosexuality was illegal in every state but Illinois, and municipal police would often relieve their boredom on a slow night by raiding a gay hangout and dispersing or arresting the patrons, sometimes with the help of billy clubs. But in 1969, a raid of the Stonewall Inn, a gay dance club in Greenwich Village, set off 3 days of rioting and protest and galvanized gay communities throughout the country to work to repeal laws that criminalized homosexuality or discriminated against homosexuals. Within a dozen years, almost half of American states had decriminalized homosexuality. In 2003, following another burst of decriminalizations, the Supreme Court overturned an anti-sodomy statute in Texas and ruled that all such laws were unconstitutional. In the majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy invoked the principle of personal autonomy and the indefensibility of using government power to enforce religious belief and traditional customs. Liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, belief, expression, and certain intimate conduct. It must be acknowledged, of course, that for centuries there have been powerful voices to condemn homosexual conduct as immoral. The condemnation has been shaped by religious beliefs, conceptions of right and acceptable behavior, and respect for the traditional family. These considerations do not answer the question before us, however. The issue is whether the majority may use the power of the state to enforce these views on the whole society through operation of the criminal law. Between the first burst of legalization in the 1970s and the collapse of the remaining laws a decade and a half later, Americans' attitudes towards homosexuality underwent a sea change. The rise of AIDS in the 1980s mobilized gay activist groups and led many celebrities to come out of the closet, while others were outed posthumously. They included the actors John Gielgud and Rock Hudson, the singers Elton John and George Michael, the fashion designers Perry Ellis, Roy Halston, and Yves Saint Laurent, the athletes Billie Jean King and Greg Louganis, and the comedians Ellen DeGeneres and Rosie O'Donnell. Popular entertainers such as K.D. Lang, Freddie Mercury, and Boy George flaunted gay personas, and playwrights such as Harvey Fierstein and Tony Kushner wrote about AIDS and other gay themes in popular plays and movies. Lovable gay characters began to appear in romantic comedies and in sitcoms such as Will and Grace and Ellen, and an acceptance of homosexuality among heterosexuals was increasingly depicted as the norm. As Jerry Seinfeld and George Costanza insisted, "We're not gay." Not that there's anything wrong with that. As homosexuality was becoming destigmatized, domesticated, and even ennobled, fewer gay people felt the need to keep their sexual orientation hidden. In 1990, my graduate advisor, an eminent psycholinguist and social psychologist who was born in 1925, published an autobiographical essay that began, "When Roger Brown comes out of the closet, the time for courage is past." Americans increasingly felt that gay people were a part of their real and virtual communities, and that made it harder to keep them outside their circle of sympathy. Surveys from two polling organizations showed the changes in the attitudes they revealed to pollsters. Americans were asked whether homosexuality is morally wrong, whether it should be legal, and whether gay people should have equal job opportunities. The most gay-friendly opinion, and the first to show a decline, was on equal opportunity. After the Civil Rights Movement, a commitment to fairness had become common decency, and Americans were unwilling to accept discrimination against gay people, even if they didn't approve of their lifestyle. By the new millennium, resistance to equal opportunity had fallen into the zone of crank opinion. Beginning in the late 1980s, the moral judgments began to catch up with the sense of fairness, and more Americans were willing to say, "Not that there's anything wrong with that." The headline of a 2008 press release from the Gallup organization sums up the current national mood. Americans evenly divided on morality of homosexuality. However, majority supports legality and acceptance of gay relations. Liberals are more accepting of homosexuality than conservatives, whites more accepting than blacks, and the secular more tolerant than the religious. But in every sector, the trend over time is toward tolerance. Personal familiarity matters. A 2009 Gallup poll showed that the 6 in 10 Americans who have an openly gay friend, relative, or co-worker are more favorable to legalized homosexual relations and to gay marriage than the 4 in 10 who don't. But tolerance is now widespread. Even among Americans who have never known a gay person, 62% say they would feel comfortable around one. And in the most significant sector of all, the change has been dramatic. Many people have informed me that younger Americans have become homophobic based on the observation that they use "that's so gay" as a put-down. But the numbers say otherwise. The younger the respondents, the more accepting they are of homosexuality. Their acceptance, moreover, is morally deeper. Older tolerant respondents have increasingly come down on the nature side of the debate on the causes of homosexuality, and naturists are more tolerant than nurturists because they feel that a person cannot be condemned for a trait he never chose. But teens and 20-somethings are more sympathetic to the nurture explanation, and they are more tolerant of homosexuality. The combination suggests that they just find nothing wrong with homosexuality in the first place, so whether gay people can help it is beside the point. The attitude is, gay? Whatever, dude. Young people, of course, tend to be more liberal than their elders, and it's possible that as they creep up the demographic totem pole, they will lose their acceptance of homosexuality. But I doubt it. The acceptance strikes me as a true generational difference, one that this cohort will take with them as they become geriatric. If so, the country will only get increasingly tolerant as their homophobic elders die off. A populace that accepts homosexuality is likely not just to disempower the police and courts from using force against gay people, but to empower them to prevent other citizens from using it. A majority of American states and more than 20 countries have hate crime laws that increase the punishment for violence motivated by a person's sexual orientation, race, religion, or gender. Since the 1990s, the federal government has been joining them. The most recent escalation came from the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2009, named after a gay student in Wyoming who, in 1998, was beaten, tortured, and tied to a fence overnight to die. The law's other namesake was the African-American man who was murdered that year by being dragged behind a truck. So tolerance of homosexuality has gone up, and tolerance of anti-gay violence has gone down. But have the new attitudes and laws caused a downturn in homophobic violence? The mere fact that gay people have become so much more visible, at least in urban, coastal, and university communities, suggests they feel less menaced by an implicit threat of violence. But it's not easy to show that rates of actual violence have changed. Statistics are available only for the years since 1996, when the FBI started to publish data on hate crimes broken down by the motive, the victim, and the nature of the crime. Even these numbers are iffy because they depend on the willingness of the victims to report a crime and on the local police to categorize it as a hate crime and report it to the FBI. That isn't as much of a problem with homicides, but unfortunately for social scientists, and fortunately for humanity, not that many people are killed because they are gay. Since 1996, the FBI has recorded fewer than 3 anti-gay homicides a year, from among the 17,000 or so that are committed for every other reason. And as best as we can tell, other anti-gay hate crimes are uncommon as well. In 2008, the chance that a person would be a victim of aggravated assault because of sexual orientation was 3 per 100,000 gay people, whereas the chance that he would be a victim because he was a human being was more than 100 times higher. We don't know whether these odds have gotten smaller over time. Since 1996, there has been no significant change in the incidence of 3 of the 4 major kinds of hate crimes against gay people, aggravated assault, simple assault, or homicide, though the homicides are so rare that trends would be meaningless anyway. The remaining category, which has declined, is intimidation, in which a person is made to feel in danger for his or her personal safety, together with the rate of aggravated assault for comparison. So while we can't say for sure that gay Americans have become safer from assault, we do know they are safer from intimidation, safer from discrimination and moral condemnation, and, perhaps most importantly, completely safe from violence from their own government. For the first time in millennia, the citizens of more than half the countries of the world can enjoy that safety, not enough of them, but a measure of progress from a time in which not even helping to save one's country from defeat in war was enough to keep the government goons away. Animal rights and the decline of cruelty to animals. Let me tell you about the worst thing I have ever done. In 1975, as a 20-year-old sophomore, I got a summer job as a research assistant in an animal behavior lab. One evening, the professor gave me an assignment. Among the rats in the lab was a runt that could not participate in the ongoing studies, so he wanted to use it to try out a new experiment. The first step was to train the rat in what was called a temporal avoidance conditioning procedure. The floor of a Skinner box was hooked up to a shock generator and a timer that would shock the animal every 6 seconds unless it pressed a lever, which would give it a 10-second reprieve. Rats catch on quickly and press the lever every 8 or 9 seconds, postponing the shock indefinitely. All I had to do was throw the rat in the box, start the timers, and go home for the night. When I arrived back at the lab early the next morning, I would find a fully conditioned rat. But that was not what looked back at me when I opened the box in the morning. The rat had a grotesque crook in its spine and was shivering uncontrollably. Within a few seconds, it jumped with a start. It was nowhere near the lever. I realized that the rat had not learned to press the lever and had spent the night being shocked every 6 seconds. When I reached in to rescue it, I found it cold to the touch. I rushed it to the veterinarian 2 floors down, but it was too late, and the rat died an hour later. I had tortured an animal to death. As the experiment was being explained to me, I had already sensed it was wrong. Even if the procedure had gone perfectly, the rat would have spent 12 hours in constant anxiety, and I had enough experience to know that laboratory procedures don't always go perfectly. My professor was a radical behaviorist, for whom the question, "What is it like to be a rat?" was simply incoherent. But I was not, and there was no doubt in my mind that a rat could feel pain. The professor wanted me in his lab. I knew that if I refused, nothing bad would happen. But I carried out the procedure anyway, reassured by the ethically spurious but psychologically reassuring principle that it was standard practice. The resonance with certain episodes of 20th century history is too close for comfort, and in the next chapter I will expand on the psychological lesson I learned that day. The reason I bring up this blot on my conscience is to show what was standard practice in the treatment of animals at the time. To motivate the animals to work for food, we starved them to 80% of their free feeding weight, which in a small animal means a state of gnawing hunger. In the lab next door, pigeons were shocked through beaded keychains that were fastened around the base of their wings. I saw that the chains had worn right through their skin, exposing the muscle below. In another lab, rats were shocked through safety pins that pierced the skin of their chests. In one experiment on endorphins, animals were given unavoidable shocks described in the paper as extremely intense, just subtetanizing, that is, just short of the point where the animal's muscles would seize up in a state of tetanus. The callousness extended outside the testing chambers. One researcher was known to show his anger by picking up the nearest unused rat and throwing it against a wall. Another shared a cold joke with me, a photograph, printed in a scientific journal, of a rat that had learned to avoid shocks by lying on its furry back while pressing the food lever with its forepaw. The caption, "Breakfast in bed." I'm relieved to say that just 5 years later, indifference to the welfare of animals among scientists had become unthinkable, indeed illegal. Beginning in the 1980s, any use of an animal for research or teaching had to be approved by an Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, IACUC, and any scientist will confirm that these committees are not rubber stamps. The size of cages, the amount and quality of food and veterinary care, and the opportunities for exercise and social contact are strictly regulated. Researchers and their assistants must take a training course on the ethics of animal experimentation, attend a series of panel discussions, and pass an exam. Any experiment that would subject an animal to discomfort or distress is placed in a category governed by special regulations and must be justified by its likelihood of providing a greater benefit to science and human welfare. Any scientist will also confirm that attitudes among scientists themselves have changed. Recent surveys have shown that animal researchers, virtually without exception, believe that laboratory animals feel pain. Today, a scientist who was indifferent to the welfare of laboratory animals would be treated by his or her peers with contempt. The change in the treatment of laboratory animals is part of yet another rights revolution, the growing conviction that animals should not be subjected to unjustifiable pain, injury, and death. The revolution in animal rights is a uniquely emblematic instance of the decline of violence, and it is fitting that I end my survey of historical declines by recounting it. That is because the change has been driven purely by the ethical principle that one ought not to inflict suffering on a sentient being. Unlike the other rights revolutions, the movement for animal rights was not advanced by the affected parties themselves. The rats and pigeons were hardly in a position to press their case. Nor has it been a byproduct of commerce, reciprocity, or any other positive-sum negotiation. The animals have nothing to offer us in exchange for our treating them more humanely. And unlike the revolution in children's rights, it does not hold out the promise of an improvement in the makeup of its beneficiaries later in life. The recognition of animal interests was taken forward by human advocates on their behalf, who were moved to empathy, reason, and the inspiration of the other rights revolutions. Progress has been uneven, and certainly the animals themselves, if they could be asked, would not allow us to congratulate ourselves too heartily just yet. But the trends are real, and they are touching every aspect of our relationship with our fellow animals. When we think of indifference to animal welfare, we tend to conjure up images of scientific laboratories and factory farms. But callousness toward animals is by no means modern. In the course of human history, it has been the default. Killing animals to eat their flesh is a part of the human condition. Our ancestors have been hunting, butchering, and probably cooking meat for at least 2 million years, and our mouths, teeth, and digestive tracts are specialized for a diet that includes meat. The fatty acids and complete protein in meat enabled the evolution of our metabolically expensive brains, and the availability of meat contributed to the evolution of human sociality. The jackpot of a felled animal gave our ancestors something of value to share or trade, and set the stage for reciprocity and cooperation, because a lucky hunter with more meat than he could consume on the spot had a reason to share it, with the expectation that he would be the beneficiary when fortunes reversed. And the complementary contributions of hunted meat from men and gathered plants from women created synergies that bonded men and women for reasons other than the obvious ones. Meat also provided men with an efficient way to invest in their offspring, further strengthening family ties. The ecological importance of meat over evolutionary time left its mark in the psychological importance of meat in human lives. Meat tastes good, and eating it makes people happy. Many traditional cultures have a word for meat hunger, and the arrival of a hunter with a carcass was an occasion for village-wide rejoicing. Successful hunters are esteemed and have better sex lives, some by dint of their prestige, sometimes by explicit exchanges of the carnal for the carnal. And in most cultures, a meal does not count as a feast unless meat is served. With meat so important in human affairs, it's not surprising that the welfare of the entities whose bodies provide that meat has been low on the list of human priorities. The usual signals that mitigate violence among humans are mostly absent in animals. They are not close kin. They can't trade favors with us, and in most species they don't have faces or expressions that elicit our sympathy. Conservationists are often exasperated that people care only about the charismatic animals lucky enough to have faces to which humans respond, like grinning dolphins, sad-eyed pandas, and baby-faced juvenile seals. Ugly species are on their own. The reverence for nature commonly attributed to foraging people in children's books did not prevent them from hunting large animals to extinction or treating captive animals with cruelty. Hopi children, for example, were encouraged to capture birds and play with them by breaking their legs or pulling off their wings. A website for Native American cuisine includes the following recipe. Roast turtle. Ingredients: one turtle, one campfire. Directions: put a turtle on his back on the fire. When you hear the shell crack, he's done. The cutting or cooking of live animals by traditional peoples is far from uncommon. The Maasai regularly bleed their cattle and mix the blood with milk for a delicious beverage, and Asian nomads cut chunks of fat from the tails of living sheep that they have specially bred for that purpose. Pets, too, are treated harshly. A recent cross-cultural survey found that half the traditional cultures that keep dogs as pets kill them, usually for food, and more than half abuse them. Among the Mbuti of Africa, for example, the hunting dogs, valuable as they are, get kicked around mercilessly from the day they are born to the day they die. When I asked an anthropologist friend about the treatment of animals by the hunter-gatherers she had worked with, she replied, "That is perhaps the hardest part of being an anthropologist. They sensed my weakness and would sell me all kinds of baby animals with descriptions of what they would do to them otherwise. I used to take them far into the desert and release them. They would track them and bring them back to me for sale again." The early civilizations that depended on domesticated livestock often had elaborate moral codes on the treatment of animals, but the benefits to the animal were mixed at best. The overriding principle was that animals exist for the benefit of humans. In the Hebrew Bible, God's first words to Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28 are, "Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." Though Adam and Eve were frugivores, after the flood the human diet switched to meat. God told Noah in Genesis chapter 9, verses 2 through 3, "The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green herb have I given you all things." Until the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans in 70 CE, vast numbers of animals were slaughtered by Hebrew priests, not to nourish the people, but to indulge the superstition that God had to be periodically placated with a well-done steak. The smell of charbroiled beef, according to the Bible, is a soothing aroma and a sweet savor to God. Ancient Greece and Rome had a similar view of the place of animals in the scheme of things. Aristotle wrote that plants are created for the sake of animals and the animals for the sake of man. Greek scientists put this attitude into practice by dissecting live mammals, including, occasionally, Homo sapiens. According to the Roman medical writer Celsus, physicians in Hellenic Alexandria procured criminals out of prison by royal permission, and dissecting them alive, contemplated, while they were yet breathing, the parts which nature had before concealed. The Roman anatomist Galen wrote that he preferred to work with pigs rather than monkeys because of the unpleasant expression on the monkeys' faces when he cut into them. His compatriots, of course, delighted in the torture and slaughter of animals in the Colosseum, again not excluding a certain bipedal primate. In Christendom, Saints Augustine and Thomas Aquinas combined biblical with Greek views to ratify the amoral treatment of animals. Aquinas wrote, "By the divine providence, animals are intended for man's use. Hence it is not wrong for man to make use of them, either by killing or in any other way whatsoever. When it came to the treatment of animals, modern philosophy got off to a bad start. Descartes wrote that animals were clockwork, so there was no one home to feel pain or pleasure. What sounds to us like cries of distress were merely the output of a noisemaker, like a warning buzzer on a machine. Descartes knew that the nervous systems of animals and humans were similar, so from our perspective, it's odd that he could grant consciousness to humans while denying it to animals. But Descartes was committed to the existence of the soul, granted to humans by God, and the soul was the locus of consciousness. When he introspected on his own consciousness, he wrote, "He could not distinguish in myself any parts, but apprehend myself to be clearly one and entire. The faculties of willing, feeling, conceiving, etc., cannot be, properly speaking, said to be its parts, for it is one and the same mind which employs itself in willing and in feeling and understanding." Language, too, is a faculty of this indivisible thing we call mind or soul. Since animals lack language, they must lack souls. Hence, they must be without consciousness. A human has a clockwork body and brain, like an animal, but also a soul, which interacts with the brain through a special structure, the pineal gland. From the standpoint of modern neuroscience, the argument is loopy. Today we know that consciousness depends, down to the last glimmer and itch, on the psychological activity of the brain. We also know that language can be dissociated from the rest of consciousness, most obviously in stroke patients who have lost their ability to speak but have not been turned into insensate robots. But aphasia would not be documented until 1861 by Descartes' compatriot Paul Broca, and the theory sounded plausible enough at the time. For centuries, live animals would be dissected in medical laboratories, encouraged by the Church's disapproval of the dissection of human cadavers. Scientists cut the limbs off living animals to see if they would regenerate, drew out their bowels, pulled off their skin, and removed their organs, including their eyes. Agriculture was no more humane. Practices like gelding, branding, piercing, and the docking of ears and tails have been common in farms for centuries. And cruel practices to fatten animals or tenderize their meat, familiar to us today from protests against foie gras and milk-fed veal, are by no means a modern invention. A history of the British kitchen describes some of the methods of tenderization in the 17th century. Poultry, in order to put on flesh after its long journey from the farms, was sewn up by the gut. Turkey were bled to death by hanging them upside down with a small incision in the vein of the mouth. Geese were nailed to the floor. Salmon and carp were hacked into collops while still living to make their flesh firmer. Eels were skinned alive, coiled around skewers, and fixed through the eye so they could not move. The flesh of the bull, it was believed, was indigestible and unwholesome if the animal was killed without being baited. Calves and pigs were whipped to death with knotted ropes to make the meat more tender, rather than our modern practice of beating the flesh when dead. "Take a red cock that is not too old and beat him to death," begins one recipe. Factory farming is also not a phenomenon of the 20th century. The Elizabethan method of brawning or fattening pigs was to keep them in so close a room that they cannot turn themselves round about, whereby they are forced always to lie on their bellies. "They feed in pain," said a contemporary, "lie in pain and sleep in pain." Poultry and game birds were often fattened in darkness and confinement, sometimes being blinded as well. Geese were thought to put on weight if the webs of their feet were nailed to the floor, and it was the custom of some 17th century housewives to cut the legs off living fowl in the belief that it made their flesh more tender. In 1686, Sir Robert Southwell announced a new invention of an ox house, where the cattle are to eat and drink in the same crib and not to stir until they be fitted for the slaughter. Dorset lambs were specially reared for the Christmas tables of the gentry by being imprisoned in little dark cabins. Many other millennia-old practices are thoroughly indifferent to animal suffering. Fish hooks and harpoons go back to the Stone Age, and even fish nets kill by slow suffocation. Bits, whips, spurs, yokes, and heavy loads made life miserable for beasts of burden, especially those who spent their days pushing drive shafts in dark mills and pumping stations. Any reader of Moby Dick knows about the age-old cruelties of whaling. And then there were the blood sports that we saw in chapters 3 and 4, such as head-butting a cat nailed to a post, clubbing a pig, baiting a bear, and watching a cat burn to death. During this long history of exploitation and cruelty, there had always been forces that pushed for restraint in the treatment of animals. But the driving motive was rarely an empathic concern for their inner lives. Vegetarianism, anti-vivisectionism, and other pro-animal movements have always had a wide range of rationales. Let's consider a few of them. I have mentioned in a number of places the mind's tendency to moralize the disgust-purity continuum. The equation holds at both ends of the scale. At one pole, we equate immorality with filth, carnality, hedonism, and dissoluteness. At the other, we equate virtue with purity, chastity, asceticism, and temperance. This crosstalk affects our emotions about food. Meat eating is messy and pleasurable, therefore bad. Vegetarianism is clean and abstemious, therefore good. Also, since the human mind is prone to essentialism, we are apt to take the cliché, "you are what you eat," a bit too literally. Incorporating dead flesh into one's body can feel like a kind of contamination, and ingesting a concentrate of animality can threaten to imbue the eater with beastly traits. Even Ivy League university students are vulnerable to the illusion. The psychologist Paul Rosen has shown that students are apt to believe that a tribe that hunts turtles for their meat and wild boar for their bristles are probably good swimmers, whereas a tribe that hunts wild boar for their meat and turtles for their shells are probably tough fighters. People can be turned against meat by romantic ideologies as well. Prelapsarian, pagan, and blood and soil creeds can depict the elaborate process of procuring and preparing animals as a decadent artifice, and vegetarianism as a wholesome living off the land. For similar reasons, a concern over the use of animals in research can feed off an antipathy toward science and intellect in general, as when Wordsworth wrote in The Tables Turned, "Sweet is the lore which nature brings, our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect." Finally, since different subcultures treat animals in different ways, a moralistic concern with how the other guy treats his animals, while ignoring the way we do, can be a form of social one-upsmanship. Blood sports in particular offer satisfying opportunities for class warfare, as when the middle class lobbies to outlaw the cockfighting enjoyed by the lower classes and the fox hunts enjoyed by the upper ones. Thomas Macaulay's remark that the Puritan hated bear baiting, not because it gave pain to the bear, but because it gave pleasure to the spectators, can mean that campaigns against violence tend to target the mindset of cruelty rather than just the harm to the victims. But it also captures the insight that zoophily can shade into misanthropy. The Jewish dietary laws are an ancient example of the confused motives behind taboos on meat. Leviticus and Deuteronomy present the laws as unadorned diktats, since God is under no obligation to justify his commandments to mere mortals. But according to later rabbinical interpretations, the laws foster a concern with animal welfare, if only by forcing Jews to stop and think about the fact that the source of their meat is a living thing, ultimately belonging to God. Animals must be dispatched by a professional slaughterer who severs the animal's carotid artery, trachea, and esophagus with a clean swipe of a nick-free knife. This indeed may have been the most humane technology of the time, and was certainly better than cutting parts off a living animal or roasting it alive. But it is far from a painless death, and some humane societies today have sought to ban the practice. The commandment not to seethe a kid in its mother's milk, the basis for the prohibition of mixing meat with dairy products, has also been interpreted as an expression of compassion for animals. But when you think about it, it's really an expression of the sensibilities of the observer. To a kid that is about to be turned into stewing meat, the ingredients of the sauce are the least of its concerns. Cultures that have gone all the way to vegetarianism are also driven by a mixture of motives. In the 6th century BCE, Pythagoras started a cult that did more than measure the sides of triangles. He and his followers avoided meat largely because they believed in the transmigration of souls from body to body, including those of animals. Before the word vegetarian was coined in the 1840s, an abstention from meat and fish was called the Pythagorean diet. The Hindus, too, based their vegetarianism on the doctrine of reincarnation, though cynical anthropologists like Marvin Harris have offered a more prosaic explanation. Cattle in India were more precious as plow animals and dispensers of milk and dung, used as fuel and fertilizer, than they would have been as the main ingredient in beef curry. The spiritual rationale of Hindu vegetarianism was carried over into Buddhism and Jainism, though with a more explicit concern for animals, rooted in a philosophy of nonviolence. Jain monks sweep the ground in front of them so as not to tread on insects, and some wear masks to avoid killing microbes by inhaling them. But any intuition that vegetarianism and humanitarianism go together was shattered in the 20th century by the treatment of animals under Nazism. Hitler and many of his henchmen were vegetarians, not so much out of compassion for animals as from an obsession with purity, a pagan desire to reconnect to the soil, and a reaction to the anthropocentrism and meat rituals of Judaism. In an unsurpassed display of the human capacity for moral compartmentalization, the Nazis, despite their unspeakable experiments on living humans, instituted the strongest laws for the protection of animals in research that Europe had ever seen. Their laws also mandated humane treatment of animals in farms, movie sets, and restaurants, where fish had to be anesthetized and lobsters killed swiftly before they were cooked. Ever since that bizarre chapter in the history of animal rights, advocates of vegetarianism have had to retire one of their oldest arguments, that eating meat makes people aggressive, and abstaining from it makes them peaceful. Some of the early expressions of a genuinely ethical concern for animals took place in the Renaissance. Europeans had become curious about vegetarianism when reports came back from India of entire nations that lived without meat. Several writers, including Erasmus and Montaigne, condemned the mistreatment of animals in hunting and butchery, and one of them, Leonardo da Vinci, became a vegetarian himself. But it was in the 18th and 19th centuries that arguments for animal rights began to catch on. Part of the impetus was scientific. Descartes' substance dualism, which considered consciousness a free-flowing entity that works separately from the brain, gave way to theories of monism and property dualism that equated, or at least intimately connected, consciousness with brain activity. This early neurobiological thinking had implications for animal welfare. As Voltaire wrote, "There are barbarians who seize this dog, who so prodigiously surpasses man in friendship, and nail him down to a table, and dissect him alive to show you the mesaraic veins. You discover in him all the same organs of feeling as in yourself. Answer me, machinist, has nature really arranged all the springs of feeling in this animal to the end that he might not feel? Has he nerves that he may be incapable of suffering?" And as we saw in Chapter 4, Jeremy Bentham's laser beam analysis of morality led him to pinpoint the issue that should govern our treatment of animals. Not whether they can reason or talk, but whether they can suffer. By the early 19th century, the humanitarian revolution had been extended from humans to other sentient beings, first targeting the most conspicuous form of sadism toward animals, blood sports, followed by the abuse of beasts of burden, livestock on farms, and laboratory animals. When the first of these measures, a ban on the abuse of horses, was introduced into the British Parliament in 1821, it elicited howls of laughter from MPs who said that it would lead to the protection of dogs and even cats. Within 2 decades, that is exactly what happened. Throughout 19th century Britain, a blend of humanitarianism and romanticism led to anti-vivisection leagues, vegetarian movements, and societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals. Biologists' acceptance of the theory of evolution following the publication of The Origin of Species in 1859 made it impossible for them to maintain that consciousness was unique to humans.